So we're going to continue reading Matthew chapter 16, starting at the first verse. The Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. He replied, "When evening comes, you say, it will be fair weather for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy for the sky is red and overcast. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah." Jesus then left them and went away. When they went across the lake, the disciples forgot to take bread. "Be careful," Jesus said to them. "Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees." They discussed this among themselves and said, "It is because we didn't bring any bread." Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked, "You of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? Do you still not understand? Don't you remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? How is it you don't understand that I was not talking to you about bread? But be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees." Then they understood that he was not telling them to guard against the yeast used in bread, but against the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Please do keep that open in front of you. It'd be great if you've got the Bible passage there so that we can look at it together and you can follow what I'm saying. If you've closed it, it was on page 982, Matthew, end of chapter 15, start of chapter 16. And there's the title that we're thinking about today. Why doesn't God give more evidence? A friend said to me once years ago, "Look, Frank, you believe in God. I don't believe in God. If God was really there, he would just make it obvious to me. He would come and stand at the end of my bed one morning and wake me up and say, 'Look, here I am,' and leave me no room for doubt, no room for question." And maybe you would like that for your friends. Maybe you are thinking about inviting them to the guest service next week, or maybe you invited them to the wine tasting and they just don't seem very interested in Christianity. You know they're not believers and you just wish God could make it more obvious, more clear. Give them more reason to believe that it's true. Or maybe you think that for yourself. Maybe there are times when you feel unsure. You want to be a believer. You want to trust in Jesus and follow him. But doubts keep coming to mind and you just wish it could be more obvious, more clear-cut, more reasons to believe, more evidence for Christianity. And today's Bible reading, it responds to that. Jesus responds to that, but in a shocking way, in an uncomfortable way, in a surprising way. Why doesn't God give more evidence? Well, Jesus seems to be saying he doesn't give more evidence because he has already given us far more evidence than we could possibly need or want. A vast amount of it. And to give us any more would not help us. Because the human problem is not, well, it's the human problem. It's not a problem with God. It's not that he is bad at communicating, unable to show himself. It's a problem with us human beings. Our reluctance to follow the evidence where it leads. Our resistance to the reality of God and Jesus Christ. And so we need a different solution to that problem. Well, we're going to see that from this Bible reading. The end of chapter 15, I think, is really about the good reasons to believe. The start of chapter 16 is really about the bad motives for demanding more evidence. So I've broken it up in that way. You can see it on the screen if you want to. Good reasons to believe in Jesus at the end of chapter 15. Bad motives to demand more evidence, more reasons at the start of chapter 16. Let's look at the first of those, the end of chapter 15. There is plenty of evidence to put our faith in Jesus. And the evidence is public. It's very public. Let me read again from chapter 15, verse 29. Jesus left there and went along the Sea of Galilee. Then he went up on a mountainside and sat down. Great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and laid them at his feet, and he healed them. The people were amazed when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled made well, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they praised the God of Israel. If you were here last Sunday, you'll know that Jesus is in foreign territory. He is outside Israel, away from believers, away from God's people, traveling around. And here he is, even when he's away from God's people, still attracting huge crowds, large numbers of people. He has to go and find a spot on a mountainside so there's enough space around him for these huge crowds to gather. Of course, they would, because when people bring him the sick and the ill, Jesus is healing them, every kind of illness, every kind of sickness, people coming from all around, traveling long distances and staying for a long time to hear him and to see him and to receive his healing and the amazing things that he does. You see that in verse 30. It says, great crowds, a whole load of different needs. Then it says, and many others. There are many, many there. And verse 31, the people were amazed. They praised the God of Israel. You see that they're not from Israel. This is not their God they're praising. They don't know about him. They have their own religion or their own ideas or no faith at all, perhaps. But they've come, and this Jesus leads them to praise the God of Israel and gives them reason to believe in that God and trust in that God and be amazed by that God. So the reasons to believe in Jesus are public reasons to believe. And they go beyond a small community to the wide general public of people outside Israel. And secondly, they are plentiful. There are many plentiful reasons to believe. Let me read the next little section from verse 32. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry, or they may collapse on the way. His disciples answered, where could we get enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd? How many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. 7, they replied, and a few small fish. He told the crowds to sit down on the ground. Then he took the 7 loaves and the fish, and when he had given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples. They, in turn, to the people, they all ate and were satisfied. Afterwards, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who ate was 4,000 men, besides women and children. After Jesus had sent the crowd away, he got into the boat and went to the vicinity of Magadan. You see, the crowds have come from so far to see Jesus, and they've been there for so long, 3 days now. Their packed lunch, their baskets of food are now sitting empty. And they're getting hungrier and hungrier, but Jesus is so fascinating and so amazing and so inspiring that they just stay, even though they're getting faint with hunger. Such a large number of people are not, you know, they don't have Tesco Extra. They just have little villages with small markets. There's no food available for all these people locally. So what is going to happen? How are they going to get back home again without collapsing on the journey? Well, Jesus has compassion on them. And he is able to provide a vast amount of food from a very tiny amount of food. They start, Jesus wants them to notice the quantities here. He actually asks them to count. How many loaves do you have, he says. Well, they start with just 7 loaves of bread. And by the end, by the time everybody, thousands of people have eaten, they have more than they started with. Not 7 loaves, but 7 whole baskets full of leftover, of broken bits and pieces that they've gone round and collect it up. Very tidy, not like students in Cambridge. They tidy up after themselves after they've had their big party in the public area, and they gather up all this vast quantity of bread, far more than they started with. And all ate and satisfied. Jesus seems to want them to count. I guess it would have been difficult. Can you imagine children charging around the place? Which family do they belong to? And a mother here chasing after their child. And have I counted them already? In the end, they seem to have just rounded it up. A nice round number, 4,000. They haven't even bothered to count the women and the children. Perhaps the men stay still for longer. But they've just kind of made a rough estimate of the number of men who are there, and it is 4,000. I don't think there's a special meaning in any of these numbers. If there is, then the writer hasn't bothered to mention it. It's not a code that we need to decipher. It's a very simple point. What a lot of people. And what a huge amount. If he just said, you know, if we just read in the Bible that Jesus took a small amount of food and made it go a long way, that wouldn't impress us, would it, in quite the same way? Really useful to know that it was just 7 small pieces of bread and fish and a crowd of many more than 4,000 and 7 basketfuls left over. Because when Jesus proves himself, when he shows himself, he shows himself in a plentiful way and in a full way. He shows that he's the God who creates everything from nothing. He's the God who provides and sustains for us, the God who gives us this day our daily bread. He's the God who showed himself in the history of Israel, who did something like this years before, who spoke from a mountainside and fed hungry people in the wilderness. Jesus is saying, I am that God. In human form, in history. That God of compassion who loves and forgives and who sends everyone away satisfied and full. Now it might just be that by this point you're starting to think this sermon seems a little familiar. Have you had that feeling? You know, you're watching a TV program, maybe Netflix or something like that, or some channel with lots of repeats, and about halfway through you think, actually, I think I've seen this episode before. Is this the one I watched last week? Have I started again in the same place? I think I know what's going to happen next. Well, you could be forgiven for thinking that about this sermon. You have had this sermon before, only a couple of weeks ago. And this Bible reading is very, very similar to one that we had just a few chapters before in Matthew's Gospel. The Sunday before last, the feeding of the 5,000 Jewish people, Matthew chapter 14. Now the feeding of 4,000 non-Jewish people, in Matthew 15. Why does Matthew want us to know that these things keep happening again and again? Well, because Jesus reveals himself in such a plentiful way, such a complete way, such a full way, that he did it again and again, that this was very public and very visible. It wasn't just Israel, it was the wider area. It wasn't just once that Jesus was speaking and ran out of food and fed vast amounts of people. It happened a number of times. It wasn't just once that Jesus healed someone in an amazing way. Whole communities were coming to him constantly and finding these healings happening. At the time of Jesus, for that generation, in that time, the evidence was huge and was public and was plentiful. And I want to suggest that the evidence for Jesus has only grown and increased since that time. There are now church communities in almost every part of the world. The evidence for Jesus, the eyewitnesses, a series of different eyewitnesses recording their experiences, all of those documents, or most of them, gathered together in the Bible, which has become a world bestseller. Hard to find places in the world that don't have Bibles and church communities not far away. This is huge. This is public. Some names are big, aren't they? McDonald's, a big name. Go to most of the world, people have heard the word McDonald's. Not the whole world. I spent some time in a country recently that doesn't have McDonald's. People haven't heard of it. But it's a big name. Coca-Cola has done better than McDonald's. You'd find Coca-Cola in more countries in the world, in more places. But I reckon it is hard to find a name that is more famous than the name Jesus. Try that when you meet someone on the street and you can't speak their language and they can't speak your language, and say to them the word Jesus and watch the familiarity. Oh, yeah, I know who you mean. I've heard of that name. pronounced maybe slightly differently, but known all around the world and all through history. If you had the misfortune to be here when I tried to summarise all the reasons for believing in God, you will have got the impression that there are really too many to cover in one talk. So I had a go, 16 reasons for believing in God. You can imagine it was a long and complicated talk. My problem is not finding enough to say. My problem is trying to make it manageable and to communicate within the attention span of the average person, of an ordinary person. It's just too much to say about the evidence for Jesus. Or this book, I think you might have been here at Easter when I said that I was going to try and read this. You can see I haven't managed to read the whole thing during my Easter holidays. I'm quite proud of having got that far, so I thought I'd show you that I'm making progress. It's written by a research professor of New Testament and early Christianity at the University of St. Andrews, and he apologizes for writing such a long book about the historical evidence that Jesus rose from the dead, but he just wasn't able to do justice to it in anything shorter than this amount. There is a huge amount of plentiful evidence to believe in God our Creator and in Jesus Christ. Good evidence. Good reasons to believe in Jesus. But here's the problem. Here's the problem, and that is bad motives to demand more reasons and more evidence. When we say there's not enough reason, when we say to God, look, give us a reason to believe. Well, Jesus tells us not to trust our motives and to search our hearts. He tells people who ask him that, he tells them their motives are first of all wicked. It's shocking, isn't it, what Jesus says? I wouldn't want to say that myself if it were me, but Jesus likes to say things that shock us, and that's what he says, wicked. Look with me and see what he means. Chapter 16, verse 1. The Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. He replied, when evening comes, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah. Jesus then left them and went away. See, Jesus arrives back in Israel. It doesn't stay very long. He's gone again a few verses later, but he arrives back in Israel. The first thing that happens, the religious leaders challenge him and question him. Now, these are people who ought to know. These are people whose job it is to know the Bible, the Old Testament, and to teach it and explain it to others. They ought to recognize their God when he comes to meet them. And yet they demand a sign. They say, Jesus, where is your proof? Where is your evidence? Now, Jesus never blames people for wanting evidence and wanting proof. But he does blame people for ignoring it when there is plenty there that they could have already seen. Nothing wrong with asking for it. They have plenty of reasons to believe. They've seen a huge amount of signs. And Jesus says there's so many. How could you be demanding more? You wouldn't know a sign from heaven if it came and hit you over the head. Why can't you see it? He says it's as easy as telling what the weather is, he tells them. You know how to do that, he says to the Pharisees. You know, you look up at the sky, you can tell whether it's hot or cold, you can tell whether there's going to be a heat wave or a thunderstorm. You know when you leave the house whether to take your sun cream or your snow boots with you. You can interpret signs from above. Well, it's as easy as that. If you can do that, why can't you recognize the signs of the times, he says, the times that they were living? Were pretty amazing, weren't they? To have been part of that generation. To have lived at that time. You could have gone and witnessed Jesus heal people. You could have seen him raise people from the dead. You could have been there in the crowd and eaten that huge amount of food and said, where on earth did this come from? But even then, even being part of that generation, even seeing those signs, at the end of all that, they demand a sign. They say, well, where's your proof? Where's your evidence? It's as if Jesus hadn't done it. Why can't they see it? Well, Jesus tells them, in verse 4, a wicked and adulterous generation. Wicked, first of all. They do what is wrong. We all do what is wrong. We rebel against God. We disobey him in different ways. We have sinful habits. We have lives. We have a history that we are ought to be ashamed of. And to receive Jesus, to believe in him, to put our full confidence in him, means admitting that. And it means changing. And they don't want to. So they suppress the truth and carry on in denial of what must have been obvious to them. There must be some other explanation. So many signs pointing to this can't be right, though. Wicked. And then secondly, they are adulterous. They cheat on God. They betray him. They two-time him. They go behind his back. You see, God deserves our love. A bit like a married couple who are faithful. They deserve that. That God deserves our devotion, our loyalty, our faithfulness to him. But actually, as human beings, there are things that we love more than God. Things that we want in our lives more than Jesus. Ambitions that we have. Desires that we have. Things that we won't let go of. Things we feel we need. Can't manage without. We love those things more than God. And that means that when the evidence is there, pointing to Jesus, we're looking for a loophole. We're hunting for an alternative explanation, for a way around it. A wicked and adulterous generation. And Jesus leaves the place as quickly as he arrives and says, look, I'm not going to give you the sign that you're asking for. No sign except the sign of Jonah. I don't know if you know Jonah, the story in the Bible. Jonah is saved from death, so that he can go and tell people about the God who saves us from death. And Jesus is going to do an even bigger sign than that. God raises Jesus from the dead. And Jesus proclaims that that is what God has come to do, to save us all from death. And even then, the religious leaders don't believe it. What better sign could you have to live in that time, in that generation, when Jesus rises from the dead, and yet they won't? Here's the first reason then. Bad motives to demand more evidence. It's because people are wicked. And then secondly, because that spreads, that is spreading. The ideas, the doubt, the attitude of trying to avoid Jesus, of trying to escape what is said about God, that idea spreads. And that's what Jesus is saying in verse 5. When they went across the lake, the disciples forgot to take bread. Be careful, Jesus said to them. Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. They discussed this amongst themselves and said, it's because we didn't bring any bread. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked, you of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? You see, Jesus gets back in the boat to leave the area where the Pharisees and the Sadducees are. Gets back in the boat. He's going to cross over once again away from God's people. But he's still got that conversation in his mind. He wants his followers to learn from it. And he says, beware their influence. Watch out for their ideas. Their attitude is like yeast. It spreads. Here's a picture of some yeast with some bread on the front. I bought a little bit of yeast from home. You can see it here. And Jesus is making the point that the thing about yeast is you don't need very much of it. You just need one of these little packets, and you open. I've never actually done this. I've never made bread in my life. But as you can see, I can't even open the packet. I'm reliably informed that what you do is, it tastes very nice, yeast. What you do is you put it into the bread. You can see, I'll have to wash this, tidy this later. You can see there's really not much of it, is there? It's quite a small amount. It's quite a small quantity of stuff that you need. Sorry about this. And what you get is you get a whole loaf of bread. We've eaten most of that, but you can see it changes this mixture. It's a small amount of stuff. It spreads in this mixture and it changes it and makes it into something that will rise and turn into bread. And Jesus is saying those few thoughts from those religious leaders, from the the sort of thought leaders of the day, the Pharisees and Sadducees, the few ideas that they've got will spread around the whole community and affect everybody. Those ideas are spreading. This is why we find it so hard to believe and accept the evidence about Jesus, because a few people's ideas have spread and influenced us. And so that's what Jesus is saying. That's why he's talking about yeast. But what happens is the others in the boat, the disciples, they're slightly embarrassed. They got into the boat and they didn't remember to bring any food with them. And they know it's a long journey. By the time they get there, everyone's going to be in hunger and everyone's going to be saying, well, who forgot the bread? And they're going to be in trouble. And they think, well, Jesus is talking about yeast. He must be still talking about the lack of bread. And you, I hope, can see why that was a silly thing for them to say. I hope it's obvious to you. But that is ridiculous. They have just witnessed the feeding of thousands of people. You're not going to run out of bread when you're with Jesus. Whatever you can say, whatever else you say about traveling with Jesus, you don't have to worry that there might not be enough bread. And yet that is exactly what they're worrying about. And so Jesus says to them in verse 9, "Do you still not understand? Don't you remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? How is it that you don't understand that I was not talking to you about bread? But be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees." Then they understood that he was not telling them to guard against the yeast used in bread, but against the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Well, that attitude of the religious leaders had already begun to affect them, Jesus' closest friends, the leaders of the community, the leaders of the Christian church, Peter and John and Matthew, who writes this. Already, they had struggled to see what was obvious, the great power of Jesus, the great compassion of Jesus, who it is that they're there in the boat with. And if they needed to be warned against that influence, then surely we do too. Is our generation any less wicked? Any less reluctant to believe? Any harder to persuade? Is our generation any less adulterous? What about the unbelief of our time? What about the ideas that spread quickly in our culture? Can we be sure they haven't started to create doubts and questions in our own minds? Make it hard for us to see the evidence that Jesus has given us and the reasons to believe. I wonder how many of you recognize this face? I'm guessing probably not many. Just wave a hand at me if you know, just by looking at that picture, who that person is. Only the person who always wins the quiz nights. Otherwise, nobody else. Yeah, I didn't think you... Do you want to have a guess? No, it's not, but good try. It is David Hume, a philosopher called David Hume. And he said that you can't believe in the resurrection of Jesus because it's a miracle. And miracles don't happen. You haven't seen them before. And so, you know, even if there were a large amount of evidence to convince you of the resurrection, you shouldn't believe in the resurrection. You would really need, you'd need some very incredible and very unusual circumstances to believe in something, because it's just remarkable and unusual. He was a philosopher. Now, that idea was well refuted. It was corrected by at least 3 other philosophers of his time. If you're interested, you could look up the answers that they gave. Very good answers, I think. Thomas Sherlock, Gottfried Less, William Paley. Each of them came up with a different reason why he was wrong about that. And I find their reasons persuasive. I'm not going to go into them now. But my point is that you probably don't know who that is. You probably don't recognize his picture. You might have heard of the name when I say it. You might not have. And yet his ideas have spread like yeast and become extremely popular and normal and ordinary. I've heard them on popular TV programs. I've heard it articulated on an episode of Doctor Who once. A 20-year-old student raised it with me in a discussion about Christianity. Could have been almost exactly what David Hume said all those years before. And we need to recognize that the ideas of our culture will influence us as well. And we're not impartial. We have motives for whether we want or don't want Christianity to be true. You might have seen this quote before from Aldous Huxley, who doesn't believe in God, a famous author, written books that you might have studied when you were at school. I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning. Consequently, I assumed that it had none. We objected to morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. He remained an atheist to his death. This is not a conversion that is being described here. This is just him being honest and saying, look, when it comes to whether the world has meaning, whether God is real, well, we actually have motives for not wanting that to be the case. And he's talking about him and a group of influential friends who wrote at the time. You might want to try this when talking to a friend. You might want to say to them, look, if there were enough reasons to believe, if you saw convincing evidence, if every objection to Christianity was dealt with and answered one by one, would you believe? And an honest person will sometimes answer that question, actually, no, I don't think I would. Because the real problem is I don't want to. It's not easy to say to Jesus, yes, you're right. We are wicked, human beings. We are wicked, and I am one of those wicked people. Yes, you're right about that, Jesus. Yes, you're right, Jesus. There is adultery in my heart. I owe you love and devotion, and yet there are others and other things that I've made more important. It's not easy to admit that, to say, yes, I need to be saved from death. I need Jesus who died for me. I need Jesus who rose again for me. I don't deserve it. Yes, forgive me. And yet it's not easy. And yet it has been done. And it can be done. And these disciples, they weren't in the end taken in by the Pharisees and Sadducees. The yeast of those false ideas didn't spread to them and didn't win them over. Because something else happened. And I'm going to steal a little bit from next Sunday's sermon and just steal one sentence, which I can't resist reading, from verse 17. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Peter has just recognized who Jesus is. And then verse 17, Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And that is what we need. And that is what our friends need. Show them the evidence. Invite them to come to Life Explored and look at it for themselves. Invite them to the guest service next Sunday. But above all, pray for them. And let's pray for ourselves as well. That the Father in heaven might do a miracle. That he might reveal in our hearts what is so obvious to see. If only we could.